Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Tristan and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 170 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell. Alongside me, Johnny Stufko.
170. What's up, guys? What's up, Tristan? That's crazy.
Yeah, brother.
Yeah, man. Who we got today?
Nearly 2 years. It's James Smith. James the Thinker. There's a lot of James Smiths. Very common name.
Yeah, it is, right?
Parents should really think about this when they name their child James.
But as you and I were researching and following the Thinker's path in his research, maybe that's a fake name.
We never get to ask him, but yeah, it's probably a good question.
Maybe he had to change it because this guy is, he's a different type of animal. He's a different type of human. He's one of these people that I think finds solace in, you know, being by himself in his research.
Oh, he loves it. He seems to, the fact that he really just digs in, doesn't he, in terms of like the amount of time. Well, he does speak about it in the episode, the fact that, you know, no family and no job. So no 9-to-5 job where he's stuck. So he's, you know, his time efficiency, it's on him. So he has to spend a lot of time researching. So
I just envision him in like a cave with one little candle lit with papers all strewn across the floor. There's moss growing on the walls, maybe some bottles of red wine and him just going to work.
he's so passionate about it, I think. And he's very different. He's very unique. The fact that he probably could brand himself as a strength and conditioning coach and be one of the top 10 in the world.
For sure.
And the fact of the matter is he just doesn't like strength and conditioning.
The article, strength and conditioning is dead, is probably a good sum up. But, you know, he's a physics guy. He went to school for jazz, classical jazz. So he sees the world through numbers and he sees the world through an analytical mindset. So it's hard for guys like myself to even imagine what it's like to be that smart.
Yeah.
It would probably be frustrating.
It's interesting that, you know, he's taken the approach that he hasn't been, apart from his jazz and his music stuff that he's got a degree in, he doesn't have an actual degree in strength and conditioning for say or anything like that. But it seems that he does a lot of research on all the different sort of elements that kind of make it up. And
yeah, he studied one
he's
of his
kind
own.
Kind of made his own university up.
One of that's also a common thing if you look online. All these people with their universities with like, anyway, that's a different conversation. But one of his teachers, mentors though, is a famed physicist.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. I'd have to relook at his credentials, but I think he's a perfect example. If that is true, if his degree is just in classical jazz, that it doesn't.
That's what I mean.
You can't weigh a man's.
Yeah, you don't need an actual degree, especially when you go to the extent that he goes through to find out about different things. Do you know what I mean? I think he's made it up in his own sort of way. Tim Ferriss speaks about it himself. His version of his podcast is him creating his own version of an MBA, and he's probably created an MBA that's probably better than going and doing an MBA.
Think about what we're doing here, though.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I probably learned myself more from actually interviewing guests than I actually did at university. So,
oh my God, like my undergrad is in psych and my postgrad is in leadership and development. And every time we do episodes with guys like James the Thinker Smith and Gary Vaynerchuk's of the world and Evander Holyfield's of the world, we're getting firsthand insight advice, applicable advice that you can't buy in a classroom. So maybe that's the new way going forward in terms of education.
I think it could be.
You know what I'm saying? And maybe it's almost like social Darwinism and such that you have all the information you ever need at your fingertips. Now, are you going to take action? Are you going, speaking for the general pop, or are you just going to sit back and see what Khloe Kardashian wore to the gym? And then that's how it's going to separate the beasts from the, you know, the prey sort of thing of like, are you going to take action to study and learn and research? Or are you just going to sit back and kind of consume?
Man, don't go after Khloe.
You love her.
Don't go after Khloe, bro.
I'm going after all of them. I'm sure we're changing the game.
This must be hard, man. She's got Kim and Courtney and the two little other ones.
How dare you.
Even her stepdad's a girl now.
Oh, my God. How dare you? We're being a little bit insensitive here. Bruce Jenner is not a girl. She's a woman.
Sorry, Bruce.
But it's not Bruce anymore.
I don't know.
Did you see the Rogan
bit?
Caitlin. Did you see the Rogan bit on his last Netflix?
No.
Oh, my God. I'll leave it at that. Guys, go watch Joe Rogan's Triggered. And watch the little bit he does on it. It's absolutely classic. We do live in an amazing time right now, and we appreciate everyone tuning in. So, guys, we appreciate you.
Yeah, guys, absolutely. So, if you haven't yet, please subscribe to the show via iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher. If you haven't yet, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. It really helps us just grow in the rankings, just get touched by more people. So be very appreciative. All you got to do is just search the Vision Board Podcast on your iTunes app or your online desktop app. And it's pretty simple. Just there's a review tag there.
Are we still on SoundCloud? Is SoundCloud still a thing?
SoundCloud's there, but we had to switch over because I'm not sure.
Is it still around, though?
It's still around. It's just...
They laid off like 50% of their people.
It's for a platform that has so much music and all that sort of stuff. They just don't make money, man.
Is that what it's about? And then say hypothetically, say half of our downloads are on SoundCloud and tomorrow it crashes. Where do all those followers go?
They've already been switched over.
To the other platform. But in general, like Vision Board aside, if somebody's listening to podcasts on that platform and SoundCloud shuts down, which a lot of people are predicting that's going to happen.
I think there'll be a heads up. It wouldn't be like a situation where they go, oh, well, we run out of money. They'll know a fair bit in advance that they're going to run out of money.
Okay.
So, there'll be a fair bit of, in terms of professionalism. And the thing is, they've got the technology there. So what usually will happen is someone will snap them up. So.
Okay.
I think it would just be a continuation.
Consolidate what they've already done and then put it to a different, whatever the new platform is.
Someone will just buy it for a distressed price.
You want to buy it?
So someone's going to buy it really cheaply, and that's probably the way it's going to go. Should we make it? No, I just don't know how they make money.
The vision board platform.
I think it's just one of those. There's just so much going on with technology right now. There's just so much competition.
It's chaos. It's just absolutely
too
chaos.
Much technology. I think Apple owns way too much of the pie. Yeah. They control too much shit. So.
Have you seen the Samsung 8 versus the new Apple? Have you seen the technology on that?
Well,
Samsung?
I don't like my new phone, man.
Dude, the Samsung is like a TV.
I swear, this one here.
I think I'm going to switch, bro. I really do. That's why the question's deriving from Apple has a podcast app on lockdown. The Samsung would have to be, I think they're an Android server. So
I think Apple just like, because they've been the market leader for so long, they're getting a bit sloppy, I think. Like, realistically, from the 7 to the 8 now...
There's nothing new.
I actually think the 8's actually worse. And, like, my speakerphone is, like, all crackly. I can... Depending who I ring, what I'm finding is if I ring someone on an old phone, it works quite well. If I work someone on a new phone, it works not that great because I think they've got, like, noise-canceling shit through them now.
Wow. Have you done any interviews for... your other show using that format that we used to do with the phone, and is it
work? Yeah,
is
it doesn't voice work as through? Well. No way. Fuck. Because the speaker phones used to be cleaner on like the 5 and the 6.
Yeah. You know what? I tried doing that yesterday. I was struggling. I did a Facebook Live. I used a guest and it was, you're right. The audio now for the listener, it was normal. But for me, hearing the audio from the guest coming out,
it was
muffled almost. Like I had to put my head. That's interesting. But anyway, the Samsung, you should check it out. Play around with it. It's something I've never seen.
All right. Any Samsung users, please send us what you think.
And what app would we use to listen to the podcast on that? On the Samsung? Are you well-versed?
Because the Samsung app, you'd use... I'll tell you what you could use.
Because I always thought it was SoundCloud.
No, there's another one that I kind of downloaded the other day. It is called... Well, if any Samsung users are out there, can you please send us through an email at info@thevisionboardpodcast.com? Let us know what you... Yeah. Is it Overcast?
Okay.
Overcast. And that's an app. Hopefully it's not just an iPhone app, but it's an everything app because...
And they'll be able to find us on there?
Yeah. Well, obviously you can go on the website, www.thevisionboardpodcast.com, and you can always listen through the website. All right, guys, let's get to it. I introduce the thinker, James Smith. All right, guys, our special guest is James Smith. James is one of the most highly regarded consultants in the strength and conditioning industry, with his roles going over Olympics, international professional, university, high school, and the private sector. His positions have included the Portuguese Rugby Federation Senior National Physical Preparation Coach and Performance Director. While on the consulting level, his duties have spanned the likes of the NFL, the CFL, College American Football, Jamaican and UK Track and Field, Super 15 Rugby, and the English Premier League. We welcome James Smith. James, welcome to the show, bud.
Thank you for having me.
James, like we said off air before we got you on, we've been trying to get you on for a while, so we appreciate you coming and sharing space with us. And we wanted to start this off with your most recent work, The Governing Dynamics of Coaching. I wanted to ask you what your intent was behind this and what the message is and who is it for.
The intent is to demonstrate the fundamental necessity for coaching as a whole to evolve, and what that includes in part, according to my conjectures and criticisms, is the termination of existing specialty fields, of which strength coaching is one, in favor of both unifying, but even more so, advancing and evolving sport coaching itself, in order that the profession of sport as a whole can begin to rival other professions outside of sport that are much older and therefore led by figureheads who serve leadership roles that by comparison are far more competent than sport coaches. Thusly, who I wrote the book for is first and foremost sport coaches, in addition to media, academia, anyone involved in coaching education, in addition to any of the specialty balkanized divisions of coaching, such as strength coaches, in order to show how the future, according to the way I've explained the book, is one that must require coaches to become more broadly competent in the, what I refer to, governing dynamics, the domains which unarguably and directly contribute to sport itself. And it's no longer sufficient for specialists to only understand one or two of them, hoping that the organization as a collective, as a whole, is able to, as an aggregate, function effectively, which, according to my criticism, the answer is not nearly as well as it could, as if individuals themselves were more globally competent.
Mm. James, how long was it into your career when you figured that there was an actual industry problem? And, you know, some of these, you know, scenarios started playing out in your head.
It was before I began my career. I was still in the military at the time, and I had begun reading about what originally started as middle distance running. And middle distance running expanded into sports science in general. And at the conclusion of my military career, it was only at the encouragement of a couple of friends of mine at the time to pursue a career in sport. And I was not even aware that there was such thing as a specialty coach that governed, say, only physical conditioning. And my thinking was, this will just be the fastest route into sport. And the only reason that my career change didn't happen sooner was because the first 3 years I was coaching was in America at the high school level, and I was functioning as both a track and field sprints and jumps and throws coach, as well as the physical preparation for American football. And on the American football staff, I was able to operate the full breadth of my skill, which is to say, I worked with the coordinators and the head coaches in order to restructure sport practice in a way that is much less likely for individuals working at the collegiate or professional level in not only American football, but rugby union league, Aussie rules, you name it. So the freedom that I had initially was squashed as soon as I went to the university level. Hence the frustration I was met with immediately. And I actually began to pursue other careers after my first year at the university level. And for one reason or another, I did not ultimately end up leaving the profession until I returned from Portugal in 2013. Portugal was a bit of a return to the high school in terms of the operating freedom in the way that I worked with the head coach, particularly the 15s, fully integrated and essentially uninhibited. So I was able to affect every area that I'm able to affect according to my knowledge. And so from that standpoint, it was fulfilling. Otherwise, I realized ultimately I could no longer serve as a coach in the conventional sense, because ultimately my talents were being wasted.
And James, when you get to that highest level, regarding which sport you're coaching at, could you share some insights on, do you get free reins or like an open playbook in regards to how you want to run the system? Or like, for instance, at a big school, is it passed down to you somebody else's methodology of coaching? Are you, you know, when you get to that highest level, are you allowed to do it, you know, to your own standards, or is the university have a say so in that?
Well, the answer ultimately will be, it depends upon each scenario. So in my experience, Buddy Morris was the one who brought me to the University of Pittsburgh, and upon initial offer, he told me that I would have complete autonomy working with the skill position players, and that was predominantly the only reason I accepted, because I would just simply not, I would have not been fulfilled being given a list of to-dos from somebody else. However, what is important for me to convey regarding my criticism of the position as a whole is that the position as a whole is a low man on the hierarchy. So the head strength coach at a professional sport organization or an Olympic sport organization, no matter the credence of respect they're given, let's say, by a head coach, the fact is operationally they serve a low position and ultimately a distant position in terms of relevance to sport outcome. Which is to say, if we look at an operating entity in terms of its systemic function, a business, a military, a sports organization, and if we start asking ourselves, which elements of this systemic operation could we eliminate and still function effectively? The answer to that question in a sport organization is the strength coach. Because while it's generally necessary for an athlete to do something apart from the specific rehearsal of sport itself, the nature and the way and the typology in which that is done is highly variable, as it must be due to individual needs. And for that reason, everyone must ask themselves, if the operation can function and actually function very well in the absence of one of its constituents, of what value is that constituent? So that must never leave the table of considerations, but ultimately your question was the operational freedom. And the answer is it's very much specific to each situation. Generally speaking, freedom decreases as perceived hierarchy increases, which is to say, things become more and more balkanized or segregated or divided the higher you go, which many people may or may not understand.
James, when you were at Pitt, did you get to, was Fitz there, Larry Fitzgerald?
He was already gone. However, because you bring him up, we're actually very close friends now, because Larry hired me 4 years ago to consult with him in his pre-training camp period of preparation. So I did not know him when I was at Pitt because he was already gone. However, since then, we've been working together the last 4 years.
So when you have a guy like Larry, who's just a stud athlete, from a coaching perspective, with somebody who has that like incredible skills and has that much potential, how much of a factor is it, like from a coaching standpoint? Like I always think about like a guy like Michael Jordan in terms of, you know, he's so talented and he puts the work in.
Like, how important is that coach to get that guy at his most potential when he's already that talented?
So what would really be interesting is if you asked Larry that question. Yeah. Because what if he was being honest, what he would tell you is that his perception completely changed after he met me. So upon our initial conversations, one of the first things I said to him was, I said, I'm completely uninterested in working with you if all you're looking for is someone to supervise your physical conditioning. Yeah. And he asked me to explain. I said, that's something I used to do. And I gave him the criticisms I just explained to you. I said, if we're going to work together, I'm going to explain to you what's actually important. And this covers every facet of preparation, which I explained in the governing dynamics. And so he was agreeable. He was agreeable to that. And ultimately, it took me 2 years to fully win him over to the idea for me to govern absolutely everything. So it was only, we've been together 4 years. It was the last 2 years where he's been, all facets of his preparation have been under my domain. And I think what you're asking in terms of the importance, correct me if I'm wrong, is the role that, you know, weight training plays or aspects of non-specific game preparation. And the answer to that is very little. And that has to do with a few things. In his case, he was so in many but not always, he was very highly physically prepared already in terms of biomotor ability and bioenergetic power and capacity, his technical mechanics specific to the position, route running, ball catching, and then sensory motor apparatus of defensive coverages and understanding flow states of the defense and his responsibility and option routes, et cetera, exceptional. I was able to determine that he had some deficiencies in his actual sprint mechanics. But other than that, the weights, for example, almost zero relevance. And I said that to him initially, and the result of that is it's evolved into such a way where his actual weight training, because people must understand that resistance training is a way to advance kinematic and kinetic variables, but it's only one way. So in no way is a weight room the only option to increase force as it's delivered in a particular position, or power output in terms of wattages or accelerations or velocities. It's just that barbells and machines tend to make the job convenient. However, the limiting case of them is their inability to address the kinematic approximations of many sport maneuvers. And this is a failure of many strength coaches to realize that by doing what they think is general and in effect non-specific training, that the attributes of biomotor and even in some cases biomechanical approximations are similar enough in the weight room that they're actually compounding upon stress that's already occurring in sport. So I realize I'm elaborating perhaps more than you're asking for, but with Larry, the net result of his weight training tends to be about 20 minutes three or four times a week.
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, www.divisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show.
Hey, James, when you're working one-on-one, for example, with Larry, in comparison to working, for example, with 30 athletes when you were at Pitt, how much has your results increased by just being present just with one person?
Well, the answer is substantially different, but it has less to do with the fact that it's one-on-one and more to do with the fact that I'm in complete control of everything. Mm. So, for example, with Larry, you know, we can use names to describe, but what would make more sense is if someone was to actually observe me working with him, what they would observe is James is his psychological consultant, and then we went to this other place, and James is his wide receiver coach, and then we went to this other place, and James is his speed coach, and then we use this other device, James is his physical therapist. So that's what I mean by governing dynamics. Every possible contributing element of preparation is involved, and that is why the outcome can be so much more robust, because unlike in the professional setting, in which most cases, particularly in team sport, the operational roles of any particular type of coach is very much balkanized, as I said before. You are a, in rugby union, I've consulted an enormous amount and coached in, you're a forwards coach, maybe a scrum coach, yep, a kicking coach, yep, a backs coach, a strength coach.
Is it that compartmentalized? Physical therapist.
Surely, and all one need do is look at the website for any team, look at the staff, look at the names of positions for the staff. Similarly, in many other sports, you'll see this. And the problem with that is I've referenced the work of physicists who have been very influential on my work, Neil Turok and David Deutsch are two of them, is the detrimental effects of specialization that ultimately slowed the growth of knowledge in the broad sense. So with more and more specialization, you get more and more people who know less and less about what's going on outside of their narrow realm of understanding. And ironically, what many people fail to realize is that there's also the detriment of specialized knowledge to render those with that knowledge more prone to their own confirmation bias. So it's not necessarily the case that the specialist is the most knowledgeable one, because a potential flaw of that myopic nature of specialization can render them prone to succumbing to everything they've seen already and lose broader perspective of that. The whole idea is if everything's been explained to you from the perspective of a hammer, then everything you see is a nail. And so this is something that people don't realize regarding consulting with specialists, is sometimes the specialist is the last person you want to talk to solve the problem specific to their specialty.
James, so for our listeners at home, if they type in the name James Smith, various strength coaches and people in the industry will come up. You got Diesel. And if you Google your name right now, there's that article, The Death of Strength and Conditioning. And I wanted to bring that up and ask you, one, were those your words, or was the writer headlining that? And two, The Death of Strength and Conditioning, what was the intent behind that?
So yes, they were my words, and the intent was to demonstrate how the profession should not exist. The reason is because I mentioned other professions that are much older. Sport as a profession, let's define that as a broad ranging operation, workforce, union force, representation, full time salaries, etc., is less than 100 years old. We're not talking about, you know, the origins of rugby union or basketball. We're talking about when did the professional leagues exist in a state where everyone was making a full-time living and they were represented with insurance, et cetera. Meanwhile, we have so many other professions that date back, in some cases, millennia. So let's take a look at some of those and what's the difference. So I use examples in the book, for example, a cook. A chef, an executive chef. The analog that this individual serves. So head coach. What is a head coach? A head sport coach is the operational leader, and they have, depending upon the sport, assistants that are specific to the sport coaching. They've got strength coaches. They've got people involved in rehabilitation, people involved in psychology. So look at an executive chef as one example. Similarly, in a big kitchen, they have many assistants, different types of cooking. In the French system, the chef de partie, the sous chef, rotisserie, and so on. And you continue to go down the hierarchy. There's people who just prepare produce. There's people who just fillet fish, etc. So, and there's many professions which we can look at this by analogy. Who's in charge? What do the assistants do? And I began considering so many other professions, general contractors in building and symphonic orchestral conductors and composers and on down the list. And I began researching who knows what about their particular profession. And what continually came up is how so many other professionals outside of sport are vastly more knowledgeable because of their global knowledge of every moving part, which is to say that even though the executive chef at this point, maybe they don't even cook that much anymore. They just supervise, they control the front of the house, the back of the house, the arrangements outside of the kitchen, etc. However, if tasked, any competent executive will be able to conduct any facet of the preparation of that food. To the most remedial task of filleting the fish or chopping vegetables, to any operating factor of cooking and preparation. Similarly, a competent builder or general contractor who has many different types of subcontractors as their, quote, assistant coaches, unquote, no matter the scale of the operation, they've got a variety of specialists, electricians and roofing and framing and flooring and plumbing and heating and cooling, etc. But what makes that general contractor competent? Their fundamental, their applied understanding of every subcontractor field. That's what qualifies them to coordinate those specialists. And on and on and on and on. Meanwhile, we look at a sport organization, and one would be hard-pressed to find any major sport organization whose head coach can also cover the physiotherapy or the psychology or the non-specific physical conditioning. So, and I began to ask myself this question, how can this be? How can an individual be competent to be a professional or an Olympic or national team level head sport coach, knowing so little about the domains in which they govern in a way that so many other professionals outside of sport could not even get an opportunity to interview for a position if they had such limited understanding? And I realized that the answer to that question is because anyone, this is not limited to sport coaches or strength coaches, anyone whose medium of tradecraft, the medium through which they execute their skill, anyone whose medium is a human being has a compensating variable unlike anyone whose medium does not consist of a human being, which is to say that the line cook at a fast food restaurant has less room for error than the head coach of the national team. Because if that line cook leaves, whether it's a burger, if it's fried chicken or whatever it is, if they leave the food cooking a minute too long, it's ruined. And it's immediately, their incompetence is immediately recognizable by anyone eating. Similarly, if it's not cooked long enough, it's immediately recognizable and they're held accountable, similar to the mechanic, the builder, you name it, anyone whose medium is non-human. There's no self-correcting variable, which the human body, as one example, does possess. It's called adaptation. So the human body is an extraordinary compensating organism. And this is why, while the line cook or the builder or the mechanic, and go on down the list of anyone who works with material items that are non-human, as an example, has little to no room for error, because the roof leaks, the engine doesn't work properly, the wheels are falling off, there's a breeze coming through the window when it's closed. Meanwhile, a completely incompetent coach can be unknowledgeable or reckless with their administration of what they're asking or requiring the athletes to do. And in spite of that, the athletes can still perform well. You cannot find this in professions in which that medium that is being manipulated does not self-correct. So people do not think in these terms, but the reality is that the highest level sporting organizations or individual team athletes are the ones that are most conducive to be governed by the most incompetent leaders.
Yeah.
Because once you get to that level of the highest level rugby players or American football players or track athletes or wrestlers, they have amassed enough time competing to develop skills and otherwise that they're going to perform relatively well regardless who is supervising them, which is something you cannot say about youth athletes as an example.
So James, do you think we put too much emphasis on success towards the head coach? So for example, you know, you're well into your rugby, so the All Blacks are the most successful team in the history of sport. I think I could probably jump into the head coach of the All Blacks and they'll still probably win. Like, what do you reckon about that?
Yeah, so I would not presume to criticize a subject matter domain I do not have specific knowledge of. So, meaning I cannot tell you everything up and down that Steve Hansen does in terms of his decision making. Ultimately, though, to answer your question, absolutely, one is erroneous to assign full credit to a single individual in any endeavor. Of course, a team sport is one that involves two or more contributing parties. The whole notion of best coach and coaching awards for various accolades is completely fallacious because of the multifactorial process of a sport outcome.
Yeah.
So even if I'm an individual sport coach, even if I coach 100-meter sprinters, it's asinine for me to be awarded best coach no matter how many world champion sprinters I develop, because we have to factor in the sprinter and everything that they contribute to the operation. So the only way that we could objectively and accurately assign this notion of best is to an individual whose work, no matter coaching or otherwise, what is completely unaffected by anyone else. As soon as there's two or more, it's got to be a joint assignment.
Yeah.
All right, James, it's very evident. You know how you're wired, how intelligent you are. You know, your nickname is the Thinker. On your website, it says theorist. You referenced Deutsch, physicist. Do you ever get disheartened, or when you just look at athletics or just sport, with how much you know and how you look at the world and view the world? Do you ever just see yourself totally disconnecting from that and maybe diving into a whole nother different, you know, industry? Maybe philosophy, or, you know, maybe physics. We talked to Lawrence Krauss, you know, something like that.
The answer is yes. You may recall I mentioned after my first year at the university, I began to pursue other professions and consider it. The answer is yes. And physics is actually the one at the top of the list. And even though I have nothing other than a strong affinity for it, I'm actually a student. Every day I spend at least 1 to 2 hours and I study physics and mathematics, and the influence that it has had on my ability to conceptualize and problem solving and problem solve has been extraordinary. The short answer is yes. To this day, I continue to entertain the notion, and for one reason or another, I have not pursued it yet. But what I should point out is because I operate as a consultant exclusive, I have no day job. I have no family. All of this is by design, in that I have essentially as much time as I want every day to research whatever I want. And so this gives me a decided advantage, even over other consultants, for example, who might have a family, because I'm never the individual that has to stop what I'm doing for some other responsibility. And what that has afforded me is the freedoms that I presume are linked to why you asked me that question, if I've entertained another profession, because of how many criticisms I have over the dysfunction of the sport. Ultimately, sport is, in general, a profession of parochial thinkers. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned you spoke to Lawrence Krauss. If we were to gather 100 theoretical physicists in a room and ask them to begin dialogue, and if we were to gather the however it was perceived top 100 sport coaches in rugby union, rugby league, Aussie rules, American football, the NBA, etc., put them in a room, what you'd find is the ability for one or the other room to go to deeper level of derivative discussion in terms of from most emergent to fundamental. The physicists would be there for, you know, until they were kicked out of the room or had to leave. The sport coaches, by comparison, would be there for such a shorter amount of time because the profession simply does not demand deep knowledge or critical thinking. It's not essential. Whereas you're exposed and you simply will not, let's face it, you probably will not even make it through the rigors of qualification to become a physicist if you're not an astute critical thinker. Whereas a sport coach, ironically, a head sport coach has less qualifications than a strength coach in terms of the conventional wisdom and what one would derive from a curriculum vitae. So
that's interesting. Because like, when you talk about strength coaches, and you know, we can list the names off, but you'll always see next to the strength coach where they went to university, et cetera, et cetera. But when we talk about head coaches, like Mike Holmgren from the Packers, no one ever talks about like their university credentials, you know, who they were mentored by. It's just the name itself. It's interesting.
It's true. And to that point, we must also add that credentials are actually meaningless. University credentials, certifications, I'll rephrase. They're almost meaningless because all a credential indicates is that the individual holding it either passed or negotiated for the minimum set of standards necessary to achieve it. So what we have to admit is that no matter whether you come out of the Australian Institute of Sports Science or Oxford or Harvard or Cambridge or Stanford, all we know about you is you did the minimum requirements to earn the letters. And now, each institution, no matter what it is, certainly builds its name based upon the rigors of its curriculum. So that's why it is safe to say that a 100 undergraduates of Oxford are likely to be more astute at critical problem solving and up to the rigors of intellectual study and meeting deadlines, etc., than 100 graduates of some no-name university of lower qualifications, it's probably a safe bet. However, if anyone is aware of the public statements of many of the world's billionaires who criticize even the value of a college education, then one has to give consideration to the fact of what its actual practical worth is in the world. And you know, I mentioned David Deutsch, and you mentioned his name too. He's been one who's spoken a great deal about knowledge and epistemology, the theory of knowledge, which is ultimately rooted in explanatory knowledge and the ability to provide good explanations. And so while credentials and resumes and curriculum vitae, they serve a convenient purpose because you can look and hope to attribute what you see on paper, that it correlates to actual abilities, it in no way is an assurance. What an assurance is an individual's demonstration of their knowledge and ability to practically apply it, which is not contained in any set of credentials. And so that has to be understood.
James, you're going away from the norm and taking this approach away from the normal strength and conditioning sort of point of view. In terms of you consulting now, do you struggle at all with people not wanting to take you in or even consider your point of view?
Well, maybe first it's important to clarify, I'm not a strength and conditioning consultant.
Yeah.
I know that it may sound like a conundrum, and it's because I'm not aware of anyone who operates particularly in the space that I operate at.
Yeah.
Maybe it would be effective to think of it as if someone is operating as a general contractor, you know, building rugby union stadiums and skyscrapers and everything else, at one point they probably were hammering nails or turning pipe wrenches or carrying roof shingles. And if someone was to ask them about their work history, they said, no, yeah, that's true. I pounded nails for a few years, and that was however many years ago. I actually have the skill set to build that skyscraper for you. So by analogy, I'm building skyscrapers now, and something I used to do was serve the role of a strength coach. But even when I was working as one, I was that frustrated guy saying, I'm wasting my time. There's so much more that could be accomplished.
Yeah.
And so that's an important distinction to be made. And so when you ask if organizations are reluctant to take me in, the answer is no. I do not broadcast myself according to what I used to do. It's what I do now, what I'm capable of. So, for example, I consult both with professionals and athletes in the realm of psychological. I essentially function as a psychotherapist,
yeah,
non-credentialed. And then in another setting, I function as a consultant biomechanically, or a function as a consultant tactically or technically. And so from that standpoint, if I'm introduced to an organization by someone who recognizes me simply as someone who can do what I say I can do, it's the process speaks for itself. The only problems that arise is if someone was to introduce me to a head sport coach, for example, and mention, oh, this is James, he used to be a strength coach, that would work against me.
Yeah.
Because there is a stereotype, wrong or right, that each individual presupposes someone is capable of in terms of their ability to impact or the knowledge they possess according to the title. And so the operational freedom I've enjoyed as a consultant has shed me of all of that, which has allowed me to actually do what I'm competent in, which is all those different realms, which I refer to as the governing dynamics. So, for example, 2 days from now, I'll be flying to Houston, Texas, where I'll be living for 2 months. Brian Cushing, the starting linebacker for the Texans, has contracted me to work with him for the next 10 weeks during his suspension. And So the way that I'll be working with him, we could use names for academic purposes, but the end result is I will be his linebacker coach. I will be his physical therapist. I will be his psychologist. I will be his whatever word we want to use for the methods of preparation that are derivatives of linebacker coaching. So it's in the same way, if you were friends with the executive chef at a Michelin-rated restaurant close to you, if you were to enlist that chef to hold a private event for you and some of your close colleagues, that executive chef would be covering everything A to B.
Yeah.
They might think, you know what, I'd rather just pocket this money for myself, so no problem. I'll fillet the fish. I'll cut the vegetables. I'll saute everything. I'll cook everything. I'll serve it to everyone. So what we've eliminated is all of these specialists. We've eliminated the grunt worker, the food preparer, the specialty cook, the server. It's just the chef. And so in the sporting context, I told Brian, I said, when we spoke on the phone, I said, understand, I'm not a coach. I'll be consulting with you on every aspect of the preparation, and that's the only way that this can work. And, you know, anyone listens to this, and it's intuitive. You think, well, that makes sense. Because even though the builder might be capable of supervising the construction of the Burj Khalifa, they can also build a playhouse for my nephew.
Yeah.
You're competent as the individual who's in charge. And so,
hey James, before you go to see Brian, do you do any prep at all, or do you just, is a blank canvas and when you arrive you do your like evaluation when you first see him?
So in my book, The Governing Dynamics of Coaching, I give some examples of outlines, which I refer to the process as sport preparatory engineering. So the building you're sitting in right now, you'll understand by now that the way I answer questions is a little bit more comprehensive than maybe what you would hope for, but it's just the way that I have to do it. I am willing to bet every cent I've ever made that since the three of us have been talking, neither of you have had a conscious concern of the roof falling on your head.
No.
I'm certain you have not. Yeah. Now, if we ask ourselves why, if I said, Johnny, Tristan, why? Why have you not given its due course what you'll do if the roof collapses?
Yeah.
Now, if we foil that out using a mathematical term, what we're going to arrive at is, okay, well, the answer to that question, because I have not thought about it either. I have not thought about the ceiling in my apartment falling on my head. Mm. And the reason is engineering. Engineering has evolved through the years to pass a system of checks and balances that renders reliability from the consumer. And that is why, on the whole, particularly in developed nations, most of us are not concerned about the wheels falling off our vehicles, the roofs caving in, the chair collapsing underneath our weight. We don't think about these things. Now, maybe they are thinking about them in lesser developed areas of the world, and certainly they were decades and hundreds of years ago through the evolution of these professional processes. However, now, engineering has passed the system of checks and balances where we trust these things. And the absence of this in sport, this is a big part of my book, talks about the absence of engineering in sport, which again exists in so many other professions. I like to use, it's obvious to see it in architectural engineering or mechanical or electrical engineering. If you think of symphonic orchestral conductors, they're working off of a composition. And the composition was engineered by one person. And in the case of a composition that was a collaboration of one or more writers, they were working inextricably in unison and together. Show me the equivalent of that in sport. You cannot. And so what I present in my book and is an example of sport preparatory engineering, which is an outline that accounts for every single physical action. So we remove the titles of technical or tactical or physical preparatory. Forget about those titles and just think in terms of motion. What's accounting for all the motion? If sport practice is occurring under the governance of sport coaches and things done in the weight room and on the track or otherwise is under the governance of a strength coach, show me where the engineered plan is accounting for one or the other. In the for all intents and purposes, you cannot find one. What you have is different sheets of music. So what I'm, Tristan, to answer your question, what I'm doing for Brian is an example of what you can see in my book as an outline of sport preparatory engineering, which shows how to account for every conceivable motion, whether it's of meaningful physiotherapeutic consequence, technical, tactical consequence, jumping, running, whatever, everything engineered. It's an outline. And on the basis of sport moving forward, my conjecture is more of it's not a matter of if, but when people will see the writing on the wall. And so the reason why, again, to answer your question the long way, the reason why I don't need to think much about what I'm going to do with Brian is because all I do as a professional is think about thinking to begin with. I'm unconstrained temporally speaking, as most people are with families and other responsibilities. And I already have the outlines. So all I have to do is fill in the blanks. And that's where the specific considerations to each athlete come into play, filling in the blanks with the specifics in order to ensure that it is an individualized process.
And I hope one day you start a podcast or just press record and just talk because there's time is flying. And like, you went to school for classical, you studied classical music, right?
Jazz.
You studied jazz in a small amount of time. Tie that into what you're doing now. Give us an insight how jazz got you to this conversation.
If I was to draw probably a more direct correlation that you're looking for, the successful study, I'll make it a point, in the successful study and full assimilation of, for example, jazz harmony, melody, rhythm, sound, it's very mathematical. There's the mathematical relation. I mean, the Pythagoras, one of the first credited mathematicians, scientists, one of the first correlations he made was describing music mathematically. And I very much, not exclusively, because there's the entire creative and abstract process that goes into this, which of course is akin to the improvisational aspect of jazz music. And the other part of it is analytical. And I mentioned regarding the study and the understanding of theory, because you could be a performer and not have any analytical knowledge and be an exceptional performer. But to understand and be able to speak intelligently about jazz music theory and harmony and melody and intervals and counterpoint, etc., this demands a certain amount of analytical knowledge, which in my judgment correlates exceptionally well, particularly to the way I think about consulting for sports. I certainly would not say that it's a popular way of thinking as it regards sport professionals, but regarding how I think, there's a dramatic influence, and I feel fortunate that was my formal education and not something else.
Yeah. James, we really appreciate your time today. Just final question before we let you go. I was just really intrigued on yourself personally about how much time you spend physically and mentally in your own kind of week.
In terms of my day-to-day.
Yeah, so how much, like, I'm sure that if we were talking to you 20 years ago, you might have been in the gym 90 to 2 hours a day pumping weights. Sure. But just from talking to you for about 50 minutes now, I'm kind of sensing that the emphasis you place on lifting weights isn't as big a part of your life as it was maybe, say, 20 years ago. And I think that's probably the same as me and Johnny, too.
We didn't even scratch the surface, man. Yeah. I wish this podcast would go like 10 hours.
Yeah.
You know, I'm so intrigued as well.
Well, me personally, I can say that's one thing that is unchanged. Mm-hmm. My father got me inspired to lift weights when I was very young because he's 74 years old and he's still benching over 100 kilos. That's awesome. And doing his thing. Yeah. And so despite all my criticisms and how, you know, the strength coach profession should not exist, there should simply be sport coaches who are globally knowledgeable. Mm-hmm. I love lifting weights. I lift weights every other day, and I'm usually in the gym 2 hours every other day. And on the days in between, I walk 4 miles, or what is that, 7 kilometers, yeah, give or take.
Okay, yeah.
And that constitutes my own physical preparation. So in my personal life, I'm definitely a meathead, which I think is probably not entirely obvious when you hear me speak in the professional context, but I love lifting weights, so I still do that all. Yeah,
excellent. Anything else? Yeah, one. It could be an open-ended question, but a guy is intelligent. Who do you turn to for research, or who give some insights to our listeners on if you know with all the information because the internet and everyone's an expert. Who does James Smith turn to when he wants to upskill or develop himself in terms of maybe, you know, sport, coaching, physics, et cetera?
So physics is a huge part. I have a respectable physics library physically in addition to just what I enjoy reading the most. I enjoy reviewing research. So with portals such as NCBI's and affiliate of PubMed and PLOS One and others, I enjoy reading research. So most of what I review online is either psychological or neurobiological or neuroscientific research, physics research, and aspects of neurophysiology research, biomechanics research, the hard science. And this would be my recommendation to anyone else, because as I describe in the governing dynamics, I identify what these parent domains are from which arguably any derivative may be captured, as specific as you wanted to get. But those parent domains of the governing dynamics, culture, psychology, analytical and intellectual, so epistemology, knowledge, technical, tactical, sensory motor development, bioenergetic, biodynamics, biomotor qualities, and active physiotherapeutic interventions. So if you look at those as the governing dynamics, there's certainly not all, but as far as sport goes, those are the governing dynamics from which so much research may be reviewed from these reputable sources in order that individuals who affect sport outcomes may assimilate it and robustly affect those outcomes. Mm.
James, who gave you the nickname The Thinker?
I gave that to myself when I borrow the term from Ray Kurzweil.
Kurzweil.
I heard when interviewers speak to them and they ask him what he's been up to, and he says, "I've been thinking about thinking." And that really rubbed off. Although I created the name before I ever knew who Ray Kurzweil was. I think it was when I was going to the University of Pittsburgh, because I answer questions on the website Elite Fitness Systems.
Yep.
And I wasn't sure whether it would be a compliance issue if I was to have at the university, if I was to be, you know, doing things on the internet. And so I thought it might be wise to use a name apart from my real name. And I thought the thinker would be appropriate because that's what I like to do.
All right, you and I are in Pittsburgh, and we're walking around. I used to live on the south side, and we walk into Permane's. What are you ordering? Permane Brothers, guys.
Yeah, so I lived in south side for 4 years, and I never ate at Permane Brothers, actually.
Did you go to Fatheads? Did you ever go to Fatheads?
I'm probably there's more than one way that I occupy what I'm sure is an infinitesimal percentage of the broader population. And as it regards your question, I do not eat sandwiches. So that's why I don't know about Permane Brothers I cannot speak about it in terms of experience. I'm familiar with the restaurant.
Yeah.
So there was a pizzeria that opened up literally two doors down from Permane Brothers that was the closest I found to the New York style. My family is from Long Island, mm-hmm. and so I have a very specific idea of pizza.
Yep.
And there was this place opened up a couple doors down from Permane Brothers that was really good for not being located, you know, in New York, New Jersey, or Boston. So that was one of the. Now, there was some great. I don't know if they were there when you were there. There's a restaurant in Southside called Dish,
yes,
which is
on the little side
Mediterranean.
It was like
yes.
It only had like four things on the menu. I think it was off of 18th and Carson.
Is correct.
Yeah, man, I remember Dish, dude. That was the first time I ever had a foie gras,
foie gras. Yes.
We're just going deep. Tristan has to get to Pittsburgh. Look at him. He's like, what are you guys talking about? But yeah, Dish, man. Hopefully that place is still open. That's a throwback.
That was one of my favorite, myself and my wife. That was one of our favorite places there in Southside. Yeah.
Yeah, man. It's cool.
Good.
All right, James, before we let you go, everyone get following James online. You can find his work at globalsportsconcepts.net. He's on Twitter at TheThinkerSmith and Facebook globalsportsconcepts.net. James, what can I say? It's been absolutely brilliant, man. I really appreciate the time that you spent with us.
Yeah, man. Thanks for sharing this space. We've been trying to get you on for a while. Mike Lodano, Graham Morris, a list of like reputable coaches out there would always tag us. Get James on. So we really appreciate you sharing the space with us.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you to those guys, of course. And Johnny, to one last thing I'll leave with you. You mentioned that I should record myself.
Yeah.
And on globalsportconcepts.net, I've done that. There's actually over 80 of my presentations that are featured on the pay section of the site. So
awesome, man. Awesome.
Well, not too many people realize it, but I agreed with your assertion, and I decided to do that starting a few years ago. So
awesome, man.
Everyone check that out. So yeah. Where are they going to find that? On the paid section of your website?
That's on globalsportconcepts.net on the Conclave, which is the discussion forum and where all my lectures and presentations are hosted.
Well, everyone get checking that out. James, what can I say? Thanks again, brother. And have a great weekend, and hopefully we can do this again.
For sure.
Thanks. Thanks very much.
Johnny, that was The Thinker.
Yeah, he's been popping up in our network and circles from the strength and conditioning community. Get on, and you know, he's the next level of, you know, performance coach, the evolution of the industry, this really research-based, science-based guy. He's really out there to disprove bro science. And I think the industry needs, even though he's anti-strength and conditioning, I think James the Thinker Smith is kind of a sign of things to come in terms of like looking at fitness, wellness, performance, athleticism in the future.
Yeah, I think he brought an interesting perspective. I don't agree with everything that he said. But I think he actually, you know, it's thought-provoking, and the fact that he's taken a stance that pretty much no one else wanted him. You know, I asked him that question about, you know, kind of, is he being excluded now? And this probably does happen. Do you know what I mean? Like
it's almost like self-radicating though, because he's choosing
he's brought it on himself.
But still, I think people will like I read a quote, or you were telling me about it, that he once was said in an interview that unless he's running the whole show, he's not, in terms of running a team, being the head guy, he's not even going to be a cog in that wheel.
This kind of thing is like he doesn't like strength and conditioning, but technically, you know, he'd probably go with Kush right now and do strength and conditioning.
See, I was thinking about that, and what's your theory on that? Because my theory on the anti-strength and conditioning was the fact that he's so smart, and he could see the world in numbers, so physics, that sort of thing. Physics are measurable results by movement, and the world around us has numbers. Is he saying that the strength and conditioning industry isn't at that highest standard, so the athletes aren't getting the best output?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's that intent factor that he's trying to get out, the fact that, to be hired by someone, it's more than just to count reps or to yell encouragement. There has to be a little bit more than that. Do you know what I mean? And if you're going to coach someone and you've got a theory, what's the theory? Do you know what I mean? Like, is it research, fact? Have you tried it on yourself?
Is it yours?
Is it something that you got from a Buddy Morris, or did you get it from a Joe DeFranco, or, where's it from? And like, in terms of someone giving you money, handing over money to actually be trained by you, there has to be some sort of validation for what you actually are giving them. So
the one thing I do agree with him is nothing that's come out of his mouth, but the ethics behind it. So the intent behind it. I am that type of guy to where research-based, science-based, I'm not going to agree with everything there, but I think it's a big part of performance in terms of, like you said, the money exchange, the monetary side of things. Because I know we've spoken about it before on a micro scale in terms of being a personal trainer or any coach that does one-on-one, that there is a number equated to ethics, such as, is this client overpaying you, and do you really deserve that number attached to your service? That sort of thing. And I think his stance behind all the big words that he uses in his intent, I think that's his stance. I think at the end of the day, of wanting to hold coaches more accountable and the industry more accountable on the one-on-one scale and the high professional scale of the service given from the coach. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to make industry a better place. And like we spoke about, it's unique. He's a different cat.
I want to give a shout out though to our boy, Amoris, Graham Morris, because Gmo has been telling me about The Thinker for the last few years.
Oh, absolutely.
He gave us a book. He had a book on James Smith that was like basically 100 pages straight out of the copying machine stapled together. And that was a few years back before I even got involved, or you and I even started the vision board. So that's a cool connection there. And
Gmo can sense a bullshitter too. He's very, very spot on.
That's right.
You know what I mean? So Gmo's been talking about him since I trained with him. So
yeah,
it's a long time ago.
Guys, if you don't know who we're talking about, it's our friend, colleague. He's also been on our show. He's a strength and conditioning coach here in Sydney, Graham Morris. He's really research science based, and he doesn't honey dick anybody. Like, he doesn't sugarcoat. Like, if something's not right in terms of research, he'll tell us. So shout out to Gmo on this one.
Yeah,
and
Gmo's
you were
great.
Spot on.
Absolutely. Someone else that's great is coming on next week, Dr. Andy Galpin, which should be a fantastic interview. We just wrapped up with Andy, so really pleased to get him on as well, man.
Yeah, Cal State Fullerton professor. That's where I went to school. He popping up everywhere. Another alumni, Brian McKenzie, the book Unplugged. Andy Galpin was there. You guys watched Joe Rogan. He was there.
Joe DeFranco.
And he's one of these, does a lot of MMA work, and a lot of work outside in terms of the kinesiology, exercise physiology, performance base. Taking our show to the next level again with guys like James, but you throw that preface doctor in front of you, it's instant credibility, and this guy's doing great work.
No, absolutely couldn't say it any better. So guys, if you haven't yet, please subscribe via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. Any guest requests, send them through at info@thevisionboardpodcast.com. Johnny, social media.
Follow me, guys. Easy. Johnny Stofko, all socials, Facebook, Insta, Twitter, YouTube. Follow me.
There you go. Tristan Cannell for me across all mine. So please connect, put us through little posts and things like that. We'd love to hear from you. We'll answer ourselves. We've got no robots or PAs working for us, so... Yeah, guys, please get in touch.
Attaboy.
All right, Johnny, till next week.
Peace, kid.
All right, guys.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working hard at it. Nothing comes easy these days, and you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.